Graphic novels growing in the digital world, and we're going to try to look at just how much success. I mean, and Milton has kind of documented where the category seems to be going. It looks like, you know, we seem to be in another period of growth, and we're going to kind of look at the ways from a lot of different viewpoints of obviously how we can keep this going. All through, and this is sort of going over some of Milton's territory here, but all through the 2000s, graphic novels, seem to be a key to, like, growing the audience. But obviously now, the loss of borders, physical stores in general, the former decline in manga, which is really good to see that manga is rebounding, have created a whole bunch of new challenges. The market is changing. Graphic novel sales are up again. Digital seems to actually... be driving actually people to stores. Libraries are clamoring for graphic novels, and I think we can find out a little bit more about where they are on the digital side as well. So we've got a fabulous panel that can actually maybe provide some answers to my rambling set of questions. And we'll start off right now, but my name, in case you haven't figured it out, is Calvin Reed. I'm the senior news editor of Publishers Weekly, co-editor of PW Comics World, PW's online comics coverage. But the panel, we're going to start off to my left. Layla Acker is VP of Publishing at Viz Media. Next to her, Greg Goldstein, the president and CEO of IDW Publishing. To his right, Rich Johnson, founder of Brick Road Media, and oversees Penguin's new Inklet graphic novel imprint, and apparently is an adjunct professor at Drexel University as well. To my right, the co-author of, if I'm not mistaken, the number one New York Times graphic novel nonfiction bestseller.
Hardcover.
Bestseller, Mission in a Bottle, and the Milton Steinbeck professor at the Yale School of Management. But for our purposes, most notoriously the co-author of a tremendous, and actually I think an important part of this panel, comics work in a kind of in a genre you wouldn't expect to see comics, kind of the business book. Next to him, Dallas Middaugh, director of publishing services at Random House Publisher Services. And at the end of the line, last but certainly not least, Trudy Knudsen, manager of e-content acquisitions at Fallen. This panel really, like as I said, is about trying to find out where we're going and how do we keep this growth going. So I'm going to jump to Trudy to start it off because, I mean, I think one of the great things, and maybe we haven't talked enough about it here, are libraries. How are they helping to spur this growth? How can they help it in the future? And what's up with digital comics in the library space?
Thanks. I'm on the digital acquisition side at Follett, and I acquire content for K-12 for all the schools and libraries. And what we're seeing with the schools and libraries is we need more content, have a demand for it, don't have enough of it. For us, what's hot and popular is anything for the children's. The schools are liking it because it's helping with visual literacy. It's helping with reluctant readers, not only just reluctant readers, but it's just another form of content for kids to read and get engaged and learn.
Anything in particular about how digital comics are reaching out in the space? Can you talk a little bit about how you get e-comics into the libraries?
Follett, we have a platform, the Follett Shelf. And the Follett Shelf is one single login and access to access the content, whatever kind of content you purchase from Follett. And it is browser-based, so you can access it, you know, in the library, access it at home, just depending upon the permissions that the school has set up. Right now, we have the Follett Shelf in about 45,000 schools, and that number is growing every year.
And you need more content.
And we need more content. Mm-hmm. Yes, we do.
I'd love for all the publishers maybe to talk a little bit about how they're dealing with libraries. Can I jump to you, Dallas? I mean, you're not a publisher per se, but...
Yeah, what I do is a little complicated, but let's just call me the almost publisher for Quapancha Comics. But the problem is I don't have a great answer for that. We've only really rolled out Kodansha's digital program just 2.5 months ago, so I'm going to pass on the question.
Even on the print side?
On the print side, we've done everything we can to support libraries at ALA and working directly through. You know, Random House Publisher Services has a very aggressive group of salespeople who work with libraries. Manga is very popular there, and library accounts are very strong for us, so... But really, all I can say about what we do specifically for that market is we just try to make the books available.
I'm going to leap to the other end. And Layla, maybe you can talk a little bit about what's happening in the library space with Viz Manga and other things.
In terms of the print side, we have been working with the library market for years, primarily with the distributors like Follett and Baker & Taylor, and for school libraries with other organizations like Scholastic. And as Dallas had noted earlier, manga is very popular with the kids. They like it a lot. Every time that we talk with school librarians, that is their number one circulating format. And as Terry also noted, it's a great tool for reluctant readers. So we've had really good responses with that. Our marketing team sets up at ALA every year, and we are continuing to work with the library community. On the digital side, things are not really quite sorted out yet, and that's not graphic novels, that's publishing overall. I'm sure a lot of you have seen several articles about other publishers' struggles to try and find the correct model for library distribution of digital content. We are examining our options at this moment, and hopefully sometime soon we'll be able to move forward.
Greg?
Our claim to fame in the library business is that we publish the imprint called Library of American Comics, which obviously is really got a scholarly tone to it. For those of you that don't know, it reprints many well-known classic comic strips like Dick Tracy and Terry and the Pirates and Little Orphan Annie. And probably two things that distinguish it from previous iterations and previous reprints is one is the amount of editorial front matter that appears in the books that really Dean Mullaney is responsible as editor of the series for. It really adds a scholarly and literary emphasis to these strips that previously, for the most part, really didn't exist. And secondly, of course, the quality of the strips and the quality of the production of the books is such that they are, I mean, they're really tailor-made for libraries, and obviously a lot of collectors are buying these, and if I weren't at IDW, I would be out buying them myself. But the reality is we're finding a lot of those titles through outlets like Baker & Taylor and others are getting to libraries because this is an opportunity to study and research, sort of some of the pioneers in comic art, whether it's Alex Raymond or Milton Caniff or Chester Gould. And so in this format, those are ideal publications for libraries, and as are some of our other sort of higher-end imprints, the Yo books, and some of the other things that we publish under the IDW imprint specifically. A lot of it has to do with that kind of sort of combination of content and format being very appropriate for the library market.
Rich?
Well, Inklet is a brand new imprint. Our first books are coming out in like 2 weeks. So on the library digital side, I think it's really working for a large publishing house like Penguin Random House. First, you have to deal with sort of their overall strategy of doing digital period to libraries. And within that, I have to sort of navigate the way to get comic content through that system. So it's all very new to us.
Barry, maybe you can just talk about your specific relations with libraries.
I'm here. You're from the library. Just come say hi. I've got samples for you.
Yeah. So have you done any library appearances?
Well, no? The book's only out 3 weeks.
All right.
So.
Okay. Well, we'll get on that. Let's jump. Part of this panel really is looking at. It's kind of a grab bag. There are so many different ways to kind of outreach. I'm going to go back to the manga space, and perhaps Layla, maybe you can talk about. I mean, what kinds of things are going on at Viz that will like connect you with a larger audience? I mean, you guys have been doing a lot, from new imprints to other things.
Okay. Let's see if I can make this coherent. Yes. I mean, for us, as I think for all publishers in general, consumer outreach, direct consumer outreach is becoming increasingly important every year that passes. And the reasons for that are due to the kind of seismic changes that we've seen that have happened to the industry over the past few years. The way that it used to be when I first started in publishing and even with Viz was this, is that your channels were very, very set. You sold into Barnes & Noble, you sold into Borders, you sold into the independents and the comic book shop, and the consumers would go there and find it. You didn't really have to do too much because there was a Walden Books in every mall, and those kids knew that, and they would go and drag mom and dad to Walden Books and make them buy books for them. As the mall bookstores disappeared, with Borders closing, with the struggle that some independent stores have gone through over the past few years, those automatic places where consumers could find content have steadily been eroding. So it's incumbent on publishers then to actually go out and try and find your readership. And the way that we've been doing it is, again, the way that a lot of other organizations are doing. We're relying increasingly on social media, on direct interaction with consumers. From the digital side, we have more tools at our disposal, I think, than many other publishers because we run our own digital publishing program. We decided very early on in the process that instead of just going through the e-readers, instead of just going through Amazon or going through Barnes & Noble, that we were going to actually build our own website portal, build our own apps, so that we would control the entire experience. And one of the benefits of that is obviously we can gather a tremendous amount of consumer data while we're doing this. So we have developed a much more granular understanding of how our consumers behave, what they want to read, and how they read it. And that's, we'll definitely be continuing to emphasize that kind of consumer research as we move forward.
Greg, maybe you could talk a little bit about what's going on at IDW.
Okay. Glad you didn't ask me about manga.
Okay.
that would be So, it's a tale of two cities, to take a literary allusion, but they're both good cities. And so on the print side, somebody answered earlier at one of the other panels, that content will drive sales of books, and I agree. But for us on the print side, format will drive sales of books, and in particular, our growth the last few years, a lot of it has really come from deluxe editions of material and showing it in ways that's never been seen before. The most obvious iteration of that is artist editions, of which we've now published, the 15th will be Tor, which will be out in a few weeks, Joe Cupid's Tor. And, those books, many of those stories have been reprinted in dozens of formats and dozens of editions, but nobody had ever done it at the actual original art size. And we're paying more to print those books, I realized recently, than we get in wholesale on any of our other books. And so, I mean, this is a deluxe edition that you can't replicate, you can't even come close to the experience in digital. And that's not to say we're not doing other books that are similar in terms of, they're large, they're annotated, you can start seeing the detail of Kevin Eastman's black and white art on turtles that you could never see before. Because the print quality is good and they've been rescanned and touched up and so on and so forth. So for us on the print side, there's clearly, based on the sales data, people want this sort of deluxe, tactile, full experience. On the digital side, we benefit a lot from media tie-ins because of our licensed comic books, Star Trek, Transformers being just for two most obvious. There are dozens of others, Godzilla, True Blood, et cetera, et cetera. And these are strictly content-driven experiences on the digital side. We're doing well in print with those. But it's clear that the consumer, particularly those, for lack of a better word, I use the word, you probably do too, civilians, that may not be comic book fans, but they're Transformers fans. And we keep hearing that billion-dollar number for Avengers film, but we know that money has not translated into comic book physical sales. But some of those movie viewers, I would guess, absolutely are experimenting and checking out the Comixology sales. and going and saying, oh yeah, Avengers, this is great, and this is the genesis of that team, and this is some of the other team iterations. For us on Star Trek, you know, early on in the digital age, Star Trek Countdown, which was a prequel that the creators of the movie did specifically for comic book format, was a perfect example. People didn't even realize it was a comic book. They saw it was a Star Trek prequel, and they downloaded it on that basis. So, you know, we're really seeing a lot of success and growth on both fronts. Yes.
No, I think the challenge overall is, for publishers and for librarians, is that publishers are looking to sort of replicate the business model that they had with libraries to begin with, where the physical copies go in, they circulate at some point, they degenerate, and you have to order another copy. And that's sort of an easy thing to manage. I think when it becomes a digital piece, it's a little, in a way, there are more moving parts to that, and it's taking longer to figure out what's best for the publisher, and also I think what's best for the librarian and how to handle it. And then I think beyond that is, how do you get that reader who walks into a library to flip or not even flip, but to add on the digital component to going to a library and shopping for a book, looking for a book? How do you make them aware that comics are available on their iPads and phones and Kindles and everything else? So I think it's both a publishing operations challenge and a marketing challenge, too, to grow that market.
Dallas, you want to maybe just talk generally about what's going on at Kodansha?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I actually think I should just take 2 seconds and explain to the audience who I am and what I do.
Yeah.
So I'm an employee of Random House, and I work for Random House Publisher Services, which is the division of Random House that distributes non-Random House publishers. We have a number of different graphic novel clients, the most recent being Dark Horse, which we just added last week, and DC Comics, Archie. There's a smaller group within our group that I head up where we oversee Kodansha Comics. Kodansha decided to open up their own publishing operation here in the U.S. Back in 2010, and they wanted to have a full library and a full staff and everything like that, but they didn't actually want to invest a lot in actually putting people from Japan on the ground here. So they hired me and my team at Random House to create a kind of publisher-in-a-box solution for them. So this is why earlier I was joking about being the almost publisher for Kodansha Comics. I have all the responsibilities for the publisher for Kodansha, but very little of the authority. But having said that, Kodansha started, you know, my relationship with Kodansha goes back quite some time, actually a decade. Back in 2003 when we first started working together under the Del Rey Manga imprint, which was an actual imprint of Random House. We obviously have had our eyes on digital for a long time. But one of the challenges of working with Japanese publishers is a cultural one. They tend to be much more focused on what's happening in Japan than they are in what's happening in the rest of the world. So we've had a successful program. The print program, in fact, is growing tremendously right now. But it was only actually just this last July that we launched a full ebook program, actually taking almost all of our books to the Nook, the iBook Store, and the Kindle platforms. That was just about 2.5 months ago. So it's been a very interesting process for us. We've had some books where the sales have been tremendous, where we're seeing 15 to 20% of our sales maybe in digital. We have other books where we're seeing very little activity in digital, and we're trying to figure out how and why that would be. The really interesting thing about working with Kodansha and working with Japanese companies is that the reason why this all happened now, at least on the Kodansha side, I can't speak to Viz, is because the iBook Store and the Kindle launched in Japan this last fall. Also, the EPUB 3 standard for ebooks that actually incorporated a subclause about how to handle manga and graphic novels also kicked into effect in the last 9 months or so. This allowed us to actually start doing things like doing right-to-left reading, which is very important to replicate the experience of reading a physical Japanese manga. That's something that only became available in the Kindle and the iBook Store 5 months ago, 6 months ago, I think. I might be getting my dates wrong. But yeah, at this point, as I say, we have a significant number of our books digitally. It's really just been fascinating watching what's working, what's not. And the other curious thing about working with Japanese publishers is that a lot of these rights rest with the original author. So if that original author is, for any reason at all, uncomfortable with their work being in a digital format, it's very difficult for us to obtain those rights. So on the one hand, for example, we have Attack on Titan, which is a real breakout hit for us right now. And that book is, it is available digitally, but that's from an author who's just now entering the market. It's a younger author. He's part of the current generation of manga creators. We also sell Sailor Moon, which is by far our number one book in print, but that is a book that's over 20 years old in Japan, and the author is a little more hesitant about digital, and that negotiation is taking longer. So it's for manga, you know, I think that the opportunities are just tremendous. I have nothing but admiration for all the work that Viz has done in paving the way in this business. But I really do think the best is yet to come. We're very much in the early days for digital manga right now.
Yeah, actually, one thing, that just a follow-up question, actually, maybe for both of you, for you and for Layla, is simultaneous Japanese and English publication. I mean, that's something that Viz seemed to really put a lot of effort into. So I didn't get a chance to ask you that. And maybe you could speak a little bit to offering Viz Manga on Kindle.
I can.
Okay, there you go. Awesome.
The simultaneous... Okay, just to back up for a second. So the one thing that Dallas and I, or Dallas only pseudo since he's a pseudo-publisher, has to struggle with is the peculiarity of manga is the fact that this content is pre-existing before we localize it. If Greg wants to bring out a book or publish a book, he doesn't have to worry about the pirated copies showing up all over the planet within one day of release, and sometimes even before it's technically released. The struggle for us with manga in particular is that easily accessible, free digital versions exist or come into existence literally within a day of the magazine release in Japan. When I had first started Viz 7 years ago, this was not so much of a problem because the technological capabilities that made this possible did not exist yet. If you wanted to find scanlations or fan subs of an anime or something else, you were part of this kind of almost underground community where things were passed on by VHS or you know, you got on IRC, and you know, you had passwords to secret rooms, and it was a tremendous amount of work. Like, if you were trying to track the stuff down, you couldn't just go online and find it. Then, as you know, certain technologies developed, it is now easier for a potential reader to go online and go to an illegal aggregation site than it is for them to find our content. That is our kind of central issue that we are struggling with in the sales space, especially for digital. One of the obvious things that we knew immediately that we would have to do to compete in this space was we couldn't do free. I mean, if we could figure out how to do free as a business model, we would, but nobody's managed that yet. So the one thing that we knew that we could affect was simultaneous. We could at least get the official version out there, day and date, with the Japanese version. And as Dallas noted, dealing with the Japanese publishers takes a certain amount of negotiation. They have a very different business culture from what we do. And over there, as with many other parts of the world, like in Europe, for example, digital is not that big for them. Like, people generally tend not to own PCs. Tablets are only barely taking off there. So when we were having the whole discussion with them of, hey, this is really important, we need to do this now, you know, we need to do this for a computer, it took a lot of explanation to get them to understand why this was so crucial. But to, you know, everybody's credit, to the company's credit, they eventually saw the importance of this. Our flagship property, which is the Shonen Jump property, which encompasses the things like Naruto and Bleach and all of our big titles, they took the lead. They were very... Their editorial team was very, very proactive in this, and they worked with us to eventually arrive at a solution where we said, you know what, we want to be able to release these chapters day and date with you guys as they come out simultaneously in the English language in as many territories as possible. And that is, you know, that's what we're doing now. We started that last year in January. The consumer response was, you know, gratifying for sure. And you know, we definitely want to keep expanding that program and cutting down that time frame as much as possible.
And on the BizMongo on Kindle question.
All right, and BizMongo on Kindle. So as of October 1st, we finally got our entire catalog up on Kindle. We had made our own Kindle app that all of our product was available on, but we hadn't actually up to this point been on Amazon's, you know, store. And we started that on October 1st. As Dallas had mentioned, part of the reason why Biz went ahead and why we went ahead and started constructing our own distribution was that because the existing e-reader and digital distribution in Comixology and you know, Kindle and Nook and whatever, they couldn't physically display our product. Manga goes in opposite orientation. None of their software was able to display books in that manner. So we realized really quickly that if we wanted to jump into this, we literally had to make it ourselves. And that's what we did. So, and again, as Dallas noted, finally, this past year, the companies updated or rebuilt their software to allow this to happen, and that's when we were able to go on Kindle.
You know, I think one issue, one of the great things about in recent years about comics is really the diversification of the genres that are available. Comics, you know, sort of branching out and doing books that perhaps in the past we wouldn't have considered, you know, something that would be done in comics. And of course, I'm using that to segue to you, but I want to ask all of you a little bit about how important has it been to your businesses to kind of, you know, use comics to make books that perhaps you hadn't anticipated comics being used for. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about Mission in a Bottle.
Sure.
Well, the number one bestseller hardcover.
Yeah, and number seven just overall. So, so you can also...
also part of our graphic novel gift guide at Publishers Weekly. So,
sounds
yeah.
good to me. So it's a story of Honest Tea, and one of the things that we did at Honest Tea to sell tea was we also use comics. So we have Berkeley Brothers Opus here in the front, and it's a little bit of tricking people in the sense of we're going to make a product that really tastes great and is actually good for you. But you're not getting it because it's good for you. You're getting it because it tastes great. And it's a little bit the same thing with the book, which is it's going to be a really fun read, but you're going to learn something. And what parents have discovered is they go to buy the book for their entrepreneurial venture, for their small business, and next thing you know, their kids are reading it. And it's their teens, even below that, their college kids, and that leads to great discussions. So I'd like to say that to the extent that this book sells, we are expanding your market. Because literally, the 99% of the people buying this have never bought a graphic book before. And they do it, and then they say, I got it. So what are some of the things to me which make it work? It is much pithier. Basically, each bubble, in my view, is a tweet. A tweet with good grammar. But that's really how people are reading these days in terms of tweets. You've got the visual side of the story. So it turns out when Berkeley Breathitt did his first label for us, he put the peach slightly differently with the leaf, and it was totally obscene. And we get to show you the first version he did for us and then how we caught it before he played one on us. Never mind the herring guts chai, which we also did as an earlier version. We get to in the first person. Most books aren't written that way. And again, it's a different style. So just like the world doesn't need another beverage or another business book, this is a way of doing things differently. And I think it's really worked. So
because this is a business. This is published by Crown Business. Now, what was that process like, getting the book acquired and into you know, an imprint that doesn't do any comics at all?
So that was a challenge. There were some publishers. My old publisher, Norton, who I'd published many successful books with, didn't even really have a meeting. They didn't know what to do with it. But fortunately, the folks at Random House understood it. They got it. The biggest issue, I would say, is could we deliver a book that was written in this format since we had no experience? So we have to find an illustrator. We have to learn how to do it. Scott McCloud's book was great for us. And that challenge of finding authors and illustrators and having them meet each other, that was really possibly one of the hardest things. We were incredibly lucky with Sung Young Choi.
Trudy, but could you talk a little bit about, you know, how the growth in diversity of genre, has that helped comics and libraries? As we've expanded beyond the superhero category into other kinds of categories, has that made a difference in libraries? As there are more kinds of comics?
As the comics are changing and growing, schools are understanding that comics is not what the stigma used to be. Of Captain Underpants. There's a lot of history that is involved in the comics, and it's helping learners in a new way.
Is Captain Underpants the stigma or the expansion?
Kind of both.
Yeah. I thought so.
We've got a Captain Underpants support group on this end.
Yeah. It does exist. Yeah. And we're doing a lot of educating, and the schools that are understanding how graphic novels can be used in the classrooms and in the libraries are the ones where, you know, we show them. And once they understand, you know, a book that can be used in an English lit class or in a history class, it is just another way to analyze a book, to understand, to learn. And so it is making impacts in some schools. There's other schools that are not quite accepting of the comics and the graphic novels yet, you know, but it's growing. But we do need more content, you know, that is relevant for the schools. It is in demand.
Yeah.
It is in demand. But what we see from a digital perspective is that we have such a gap in content is because so many of the graphic novels and comic publishers went from the print model, and they jumped to the subscription model, and they kind of forgot about a PDF model. Follett has different business models, but we do require PDFs or EPUBs. And so now publishers are coming back to that model, so more and more content is available.
Dallas, I mean, obviously this is a chance you can actually talk about maybe some of the other publishers, because, I mean, Random House Publisher Services distributes a variety of publishers. Has the growth in the kinds of genres that comics are involved in now, is that helping to get, you know, basically to reach more readers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you want to look at the different types of books that are distributed by Random House, and for that matter, published by Random House, such as Mission in a Bottle, it's everything.
Yeah.
It's absolutely everything. I mean, I would say Random House, core Random House's top graphic novel last year was Chris Ware's book, Building Stories, which was just a phenomenal success, and in fact really stretched the boundary of what a graphic novel was. In the manga space, you know, a lot of the stuff we do is shonen or shoujo, and if you don't know those terms, it's boys and girls manga. But we're just releasing a book called Vinland Saga that is a much more adult-oriented, straight-up Viking action story. Vertical, in particular, has released so many books, such as Osamu Tezuka's Buddha. You know, we're fortunate at Publisher Services. We distribute such a wide variety of publishers that we really have just a little bit of everything.
Why don't we start with Rich? The growth in genres in comics. I mean, or talk if you'd like to talk generally about, you know, growing the category.
Well, I think the growth in the genres has been happening for a long time. I used to tell people that, you know, the graphic novel section was like taking every genre imaginable and cramming it into one section, pretty much. I think part of it is more the acceptance is that we live in a visual society now. Everything is, you know, everything is pictures and words. So I think that's part of why they're being more accepted. I think the key is, you know, sort of the section that has been built in bookstores and libraries of the graphic novel section, and how do you attract someone who normally wouldn't read the medium to pick up a book that is not a typical superhero book or something else. Even in bookstores, things like Persepolis or Fun Home or Stitches is not in the graphic novel section, it's out in the biography section. So I think it's, at times, graphic novels are thought of as a thing, a genre, but it's really not. But then how do you get those people who aren't familiar with this medium attracted to it? I think that ends up in in the hands of the marketing people. You know, how do you get attract new readers to it?
I just want to pick up one quick thing, which is the biggest thing. I'm a professor. The biggest thing in education, as far as I'm concerned, is Khan Academy. And if you think about that, essentially, it is a little bit of animation with voiceover that's going with it. It's not fancy, but it's really this visual learning as the way to go.
Great.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously anyone who follows IDW knows we're sort of have a diverse lineup of titles ranging from the licensed books to the creator-owned books in a number of different genres, 30 Days of Night and Lock and Key being two critical examples, and there are obviously many others. So for us, diversity has sort of been part of our corporate culture and our chemistry from the beginning. In particular, even in some of the imprints, Library of American Comics, Artist Edition, Yoke Books, within the imprints themselves, there is diversity. So there, you know, a number of the Artist Edition titles are superhero titles, obviously, but we also have the you know, we have things like the Best of EC and the individual EC artists are part of that. Mad Comics, also from EC. Now, obviously, Mad belongs to DC. But things like that are sort of multi-genre. Yo Books could be humor, could be very serious, could be horror. It's really about, you know, is it a quality project? Do we believe there's a customer out there? And do we believe, and the answer is obviously a rhetorical question, do we believe that if you pick up a quality book under one of the imprints or just under the IDW banner itself, are you then going to risk the chance of picking up something you would not know because you had a quality experience the first time around? And the result for us, for the most part, is you know, has been very positive. And Yo being a really great example because, again, his interests are so diverse.
This is the Craig Yo imprint?
Yeah, Yo Books is Craig Yo imprint. I found out there's something across the street called the Yotel, which is not owned by Craig, by the way. I wasn't aware of that. So anyway, the fact that you know, the fact that he likes so many different genres, the fact that in Library of American Comics we've done you know, very serious artistic endeavors, you know, Alex Raymond's Flash Gordon and Kniff's Terry and the Pirates, but probably our biggest seller has been Berkeley Breathitt's Bloom County and the rest of the related titles to that feature opus. So you know, again, it's rare that we actually publish superheroes. And just in general, we do a few pretty good ones. Yeah, Rocketeer and Thunder Agents come to mind. There's a few others. So we, you know, again, diversity has been, that's our bloodline.
Layla?
What was the original question?
Diversity. Maybe you could talk about Perfect Square.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Talk about Perfect Square. To just pop up.
New genres. Are you awake?
I've got my water. Just to pop up really quickly on something that Rich said about the kind of growing acceptance of graphic novels as a popular medium. About 6 or 7 years ago, we commissioned an outside consultancy to do a focus group for us. Because we were looking at the comics that we were producing for girls and saying, hey, you know, the characters and storylines in this are the exact same thing that's in, like, YA romance novels. So YA romance readers should really be reading this stuff, too. So we did this really big study. It took half a year. And what we found was that there was still a tremendous resistance to the medium. And one of my favorite answers was this one girl who, you know, we go down the question list and we're like, do you like the characters? Yes. Do you like the story? Yes. You know, do you, you know, like the way this is presented? Yes. So what would it take to get you to read this? And she said, take out the pictures. So we were like, all right. So there is, the medium has grown a lot over the past few years, but there's still, in the civilian audience, as we have called it, there still is resistance, for sure. But I think that's eroding by the day. In terms of diversity, as long as we're on the topic of expanding the audience, our publishing list consists of content for male readers, for female readers, for male and female readers, of all age spectrums, starting with about the age of 7, on up. We publish kids titles, we publish titles that are rated R, or the equivalent of it. And the reason we do so consciously because we want to help expand that audience. And there are, you know, there's obviously a demand for it. The 35-year-old guy who's going to read, you know, a mature title on his iPad, and the 6-year-old girl who's going to pick up the latest, you know, volume of Pokemon from her Barnes & Noble. We want to be able to serve that entire range of graphic novel consumer. So we have been publishing titles for children for several years, mainly through our licensed properties like Pokemon, like Legend of Zelda. And then 3 years ago, we launched a kind of, I don't want to say completely new, but we significantly expanded our children's publishing program. Because we were looking at the marketplace and we did not, you know, as Terry was saying, for kids, there's a tremendous demand for content, and there, at that time, was not enough being produced to fill it. So we said, okay, well, let's do this. So we started with our licensed properties, started doing original content as well, and we started moving into non-Japanese content also, which was kind of a, not necessarily a first for our company, but was more significant than we had done. This past summer, we announced it at San Diego Comic-Con. We rebranded and relaunched the imprint as Perfect Square. The name is kind of a play on the square comic panel, and also on being a square when you're a kid and reading the graphic novels, which is perfect, I think, for a lot of kids. So we have our licensed content in there from Japan, as well as a lot of big Western properties. We've been working with licensors like Mattel, with Ugly Doll. We have a big Hello Kitty book that's coming up, and we've just seen, you know, we've seen a really good response. Institutions want these titles, parents want these titles, and you know, hopefully we'll continue to expand it.
Yeah, I will respond to something you say, but then you can jump in.
I should go back to the acceptance and growth of the medium. I think one thing that is very positive about it, and that we saw in the statistics here, is the growth of the kids' graphic novel area. If you look at 15 years ago, when I started DC Comics, there was no distribution really in bookstores or libraries for graphic novels. There was no digital. You've now got a generation or two of kids who have grown up where it's not an unusual thing to walk into a bookstore or a library or open your iPad, and you can get a comic or a graphic novel very easily. It's probably the best time since the 1930s and 40s where comics are available to the general public. And I think that bodes well for the growth of this industry and the acceptance of it. So now you've got kids who were manga fans in the early to mid-2000s who are now, you know, out of college, they're starting to have kids. So for them to give their kid a comic to read is not going to be as big of a deal as it was 20 years ago for previous generations.
Yeah. I was just going to follow up on something Layla said regarding girls, in that, you know, My Little Pony has been a breakthrough title, I think not only for us, but for the industry in general. And, you know, obviously, those of you that follow the My Little Pony story know that there are what are called bronies, which are yes. Adults, many of whom are male, mostly male, who find a certain sort of quirky character about the show and about the comic that drives them to the store. But we always ask reach outers. Whenever I go into a comic book retail store, it's probably the first question I ask is, who's buying ponies? And there are quite a few little girls coming in with their families, with their parents, and buying the pony comics that, you know, maybe this is, you know, maybe this is the entry drug for them into the comic book world. The nice thing about ponies, getting back to the, you know, without pictures though, the nice thing about My Little Pony is the comic book really replicates in a 2D format the TV show, I think. And obviously the reviews, you know, have echoed that. So the girls who are already watching the show and getting the stories and getting the character development from the ponies that they wanted, and we've tried to provide added value in the pony line, and I'd like to think to some extent succeeded. You know, we had Powerpuff Girls just come out a week ago, and that seems to, despite the fact that it's been off the air for 10 years, that seems to be also attracting a few young girl kids to the to the mix. So, I mean, that's just, you know, for us, it's been a giant positive story. In particular, Scholastic's order of My Little Pony product from us was greater than they had ever ordered anything. Transformers, Turtles, all the traditional sort of boy action products from us. So, good news.
All right, well, let's get some questions from the audience. So we'll start with you, Rob, right down front.
This actually started with something Craig was saying, but Rich just piped in on it, too. In the comparison between sort of these wonderful prestige edition books that are starting to happen now and these more expensive things like library collection editions versus the digital, which is a little bit more of the collected ephemeral reading, you know? Here's something for the kids to read. Here's something that you can carry on your phone with you. I wonder if you guys have thought about what that does in terms of the current comics market. Like, you know, what does that do to the consumer? That these art books are now $100 versus the, you know, $4 floppy book. Nobody ever thought they'd see. Are we going to see a world where more of the regular updated stories are occurring digitally and where the books that people are buying, prestige objects, are the art book editions?
You know, I think I'd have to say, in the broad strokes, the answer is probably yes. And I think, again, our focus on print side has been making on the collections really high-quality books that you can't replicate digitally to sort of, you know, as sort of saying, this is a reason to keep buying print. On the comic book side, you know, we still make a high-quality product for the comic book first, knowing well that we're going to, you know, be launching the digital at the same time. But I think logically, as I particularly watch my own kids and other young kids who do a lot of their reading and just they're interacting with the world is all digital, I would imagine as they get older and, you know, they have their own disposable income as opposed to relying on allowances and so forth, you know, I would guess that the digital experience from a content standpoint, you know, that will be essential. They're not going to buy DVDs, they're going to download movies and they're... And the same may be true, ultimately, with comic books, but you can't download an artist edition. And we're going to keep making more of those.
Anybody else want to? No? All right, other questions? Okay, Kate?
Okay, when you go about publishing something of a new genre or a new style, something you don't normally do, something that's a little different, like Honesty or indeed like Ponies, and where you're talking to a slightly different audience, how do you go about selling something new?
Yeah. How do you go about selling something new?
Right, when you have one of those new products that's a little different, like the Honest Tea thing or the Ponies or whatever.
Okay. How do you get traction out there for something that's new and not aimed at your normal audience?
I think sometimes the market and helps guide that. One of the first books we're doing at Inklet is a book called Unforgotten by an Australian artist by the name of Toby Riddle. And it's unusual in that it's a photo and line art about an angel whose burden is too much for her to bear and she falls to earth. And because of the unusual content of it, even though it is sort of billed as a graphic novel, it didn't go to the graphic novel section in most stores. It went to the inspirational section. And because of that, it got different kind of attention. It's even going to be on the gift table at Barnes & Noble this fall. So I think sometimes the market helps decide that, and I think it decides that too when it's something like a graphic memoir. But it's also how the publisher tries to position it, too.
Anyone else?
Okay. A lot of speaking. A lot of traveling, going to events, conferences. We created an animation that we put up on Amazon and on our website, finding ways to publicize it through the bottles and using the labels as marketing tools. But the challenge, there's an expression in Hebrew, it's called parva. So you're not meat and you're not milk. And you get caught in the middle, and then nobody reviews you because the business books think you're a cartoon, the cartoon books think you're a business, and that's really the challenge, is creating this new category.
Question right down here.
How do you decide on the price point?
Who wants to take that?
Dartboards.
Best guess. You look at a P&L, you try to make a P&L for the book. What are your costs against what the market is doing, too? I mean, you don't want to overprice yourself or out of the market in order not to sell the book, but it also depends on what it is. I mean, that Unforgotten book that we did, we priced it as a gift book for $20. In Australia, it's $35, you know, for the original edition. It's your costs against what you think it'll do in the market and what the market is currently doing with pricing.
Okay.
the dark.
Darts.
I was hoping Michael could answer that question.
Okay, Michael.
I'm the one who said darts, but no, I think Rich is right. You start with the P&L, and you kind of work backwards, and you oftentimes price less for a first volume. You oftentimes price less if you're trying to introduce something. Mm-hmm. You put value pricing on it that way. And two other quick comments. One, when we started doing library shows in the late 90s, the mantra was it's a format, not a genre. And, just kept hammering that home. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that was touched on a little bit here is we've talked a lot about differentiating a book from digital by kind of fetishizing the book, mm-hmm. putting together a really nice package that feels really good in your hand that people want to buy. And I think that's a big difference between the two.
More questions? You.
I actually have some questions with digital manga publishing as well. Now, one of the most requested things, at least I hear about, is definitely cross-tablet support on digital manga, as well as the option to both do it in both English and the Japanese versions. So is this something that generally comes about?
Okay. Cross-tablet support. And
cross-language support and also cross-language
and cross-language support. On digital.
Cross-tablet support, I'm not entirely sure what...
You mean different platforms, be it you're Apple or Android or what?
Yeah, because actually the Viz app works on my Samsung Galaxy 3, but it doesn't work on my Galaxy Tab 2, but it is all available across all iOS platforms.
Yeah, it is available. If it's not working on one of the Android devices, that's not something that I'm aware of. I think that if there is a case where there's holes in our functionality with different Android tablets at this point, that's something that we should be addressing for sure. In terms of the language capability. That's not something that we've honestly thought about because nobody's really demanded it of us yet, but it would be possible, presumably, like through some sort of toggle mechanism or something like that. But to be honest, this is the first time that I've heard that request, so it hasn't been a very mass thing for us.
Dallas, do you want to...
I'd say, actually, that's the first time anybody's ever asked for that, so it's not something that's on our radar.
Other questions? In the back.
We've heard about distribution, we've heard about publishing and that. How can journalists, what do we write, what do we need to do to help grow this?
Yeah, how do you help the journalists in the room here? The media. Is that your question? How do you get your message out to the media?
How do we help you?
Yeah, how do you help the media write about your books?
Reviews and interviews.
Yeah.
But what are the things we're missing?
I'll give you one quick example. I wrote an op-ed which was illustrated with cartoons, and the New York Times basically said, well, we like the op-ed, but we don't know what to do with the illustrations. And it was like, well, wait a second, that was the package. And again, it fell in the middle.
Rich?
So the question is...
I'm a journalist. I've been doing this for 30 years in this field, going all the way back. And I really want to promote comic books, not to people who are already reading comic books, but to people who are not reading comic books. I want to write about comic books in a non-comic book field.
So the question is, how can you help us, correct?
Exactly.
Okay. So I think depending upon your platform, whatever site you're writing for, is it an issue where you're not getting enough space or time to get the word out about more than just DC and Marvel?
If you work for, let's say, Publishers Weekly or any other mainstream publication, you need those books 4 months in advance.
Right.
For instance. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they won't accept those reviews.
Right. So is that still an issue with everybody, that you're not getting it early? So the question is, how can we help you? How can we help each other? Well, let's hold hands and figure it out.
Well, at PW, we actually have spent about the last 15 or 20 years actually trying to get comics publishers to deliver material materials to us more in the way that is, you know, considered normal in the book trade, yes. Yeah. And, you know, we've had, you know, pretty good success. It can always be better.
I think a way is just to report more about it. If these sites, and I also think, you know, the sites that are devoted to promoting your books, like PW and Book Reporter and ICB2, as publishers, you got to support them more, you know, by marketing and opening up and talking about your books too.
And I'll quickly follow up on what Michael in the audience said earlier about talking about these. If we start thinking of this as a format as opposed to a genre, then different types of journalists will write about them. My big thing is, particularly the art edition books, the Yale books, and the library books, is get people who cover art to write about. These are fine artists. Their originals sell for as much as all the other fine artists that we know about and that we follow. And getting an art editor to pay attention to, you know, whether it's an art edition, whether it's, you know, the biography of Milton Caniff that we did, you know, getting people to focus on that from that perspective, and then again going into the different categories. You know, if we're a genre, then the comic book or graphic novel beat reporter will write about us. If we're a format, we cross into all the different subject matters in the media and the press.
Sure.
From my perspective, I'm not interested in writing about Marvel and DC. No disrespect to Marvel and DC. I've been reading them my entire life. It's something that, for Marvel and DC, has to be phenomenal to even talk about it. I really want to write about non-superhero comics. I want to write about comic books that are just different. I want it because it's not just superhero. It's all kinds of different.
And can I ask, are we talking comics-based sites and publications or more mainstream mass market sort of things?
I write for Examiner.com.
For who, I'm sorry?
Examiner.com.
Okay.
Is a mass market site.
Okay.
I'm looking for something different.
And do they give you a lot of leeway in what you're able to write about?
I'm sorry?
Do they give you a lot of leeway?
I can write about whatever I want.
Okay.
More questions?
Yes. I'm curious.
This was a hot topic a few years ago. I'm not sure it is anymore, but...
Dallas, do you want to go first?
Who wants to take that?
Sure. It's really straightforward, purely from a business perspective, not an artistic perspective. The only manga not by Japanese artists that sells are manga attached to known licenses and properties. It's very, very rare for a non-Japanese manga that's an entirely original work to break out of the field. It's not something that I really have to deal with anymore at Kodansha, because all we publish are Kodansha books from Japan. But I study the top 10,000 list of BookScan very closely, and the non-Japanese manga that break out there are typically things like Jens James Patterson books, the Twilight manga, things like that.
Tokyopop did the most in trying to push this area forward.
They also did the most damage.
They also did the most
sorry.
Damage.
That was what they're really saying.
Those were the days, yeah.
It's no hard feelings. and to their credit, they did... they did discover some really amazing young talent. I believe Felipe Smith came out through that first. Jen Lee Quick,
Svetlana
Tvakova. Yes. Like, it wasn't necessarily that there is an absolute shortage of talent on the part of American creators, but there's two really big issues that make this extremely problematic, which is that one, I think most people here aren't aware of the extent to which manga comes out of a huge, very regimented kind of apprenticeship system in Japan, and the sheer scale of that industry. The reason why manga artists are able to be developed at such an amount in what is relatively a small population is that because there's an enormous long-standing industry that is dedicated only to creating these artists. these kids, you know, the younger artists, they don't just like, you know, pop out of, you know, Zeus's forehead immediately and publish a novel. I mean, they're apprenticing for years beforehand. They're starting with backgrounds. They're starting with drawing panel edges. Most of them, I mean, there's exceptions where there will be a genius that comes through every once, you know, in a while, and they will just go out and publish a graphic novel, but that's extremely rare. They learn how to create comics, and more importantly, they learn how to create comics on an extremely strict schedule with high quality standards. If I had to point to one thing that bars American artists from participating and from creating these kinds of works, is that they have no support system and no way to get that kind of experience. It's kind of like, you know, Mario Batali has a good, or Joe Bastianich, I think, had a good quote about what makes a great restaurant great. He's like, look, given the right ingredients and given enough time, anybody can produce a gourmet meal. He said the reason why these restaurants are what they are is that we do it every single night after night for 365 days a year. And with graphic novel creators, I think that aspect of it is not foremost in people's minds. If you know, have enough talent, sure, you can sit down and produce a very, very pretty page of comics, but you have to be able to do it for an entire book on your publisher's schedule consistently for multiple volumes. And that sort of infrastructure just does not exist in this country.
I was the co-founder of Beyond Press, so we actually did publish some of the books that Elvis talked about. I think one of the issues here is that the generation that grew up on manga, they have nowhere to go to support you to cut their teeth. You know, the Japanese publishers do not allow them to work on their properties. Unlike American artists who can go work for DC, Marvel, Valiant, Dark Horse, there's no place for them to get their craft out before they take a property out on their own. So I don't know how that will change or if that will change. And I think it's a little bit more of a risk for a publisher to do something that is a manga style when, to echo what Dallas said, you know, Tokyo Pop, they weren't always terrific books in a way.
And I think we're going to wrap up on that note. Thanks to this great panel. Thank you.